Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And we are going to talk about the environment this hour of our program. Very interesting article in the magazine E, the environmental magazine, that that addresses something I think many of us have been thinking about as we see a whole lot of snow and then not very much snow, and have had a few winters here where it was hard to go cross-country skiing or ice skating, or some of you may be snowmobilers. The article is Losing Winter: As Climate Change Takes Hold, Our Coldest Season is the First Casualty. And our guest writes that the warming changes already visible are the tip of the iceberg. In the next few decades, global warming will be shaped by many different factors with relatively unpredictable results. But the scientific consensus is near unanimous that the loss of predictable and comforting winter patterns will be a major consequence. Nostalgia for snowy winters past and the way it was will be a major growth industry, even as skiing, skating, snowmen building, and maple syrup making gradually recede in our collective memory. Joining us this hour is the author of that article and the editor of E, the environmental magazine. Jim Montevalli is here. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be on.
You know, those of us who live in Wisconsin, I think over the last couple of years, have noticed that there aren't as many days to go cross-country skiing. The ice skating ponds are sometimes water in January. We had tornadoes here just a couple of days ago, which is almost unheard of. But you really have evidence that it's affecting a lot of industries, particularly in the eastern United States. The snow just isn't there. It's just not as cold.
Well, we looked particularly at New England because it's so often associated with traditional winter activities like skiing and making maple syrup and all those things. And New England is really hurting, particularly the ski areas, the dealers of snowmobiles, as you mentioned, the people who sell cross-country skis or skiing equipment, even skiing clothing. We talked to one manufacturer said he was getting out of the whole business of making winter-related clothing and was getting into surf-related stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you believe that?
No.
That was Patagonia, big company.
Oh, it is a big company. Yeah, and there have been just a lot of places that have tried to keep it going, but over the last, year or two, they've just, snowmobile makers have just called it quits.
Right. They had a very bad year last year, and I talked to representative of the Snowmobile Association, and he said, when there's no snow, nobody buys snowmobiles.
Hmm.
You know, it's kind of obvious.
Exactly. What about downhill ski areas? You mentioned that a number of them have closed.
Well, it's not so much that they close, it's that they have to adopt. In order to survive, they have to sort of evolve into something different. And what they generally do is try to become more of a summer destination.
Hmm.
You know, if you look at some of the ski areas in Vermont, they operate what amount to sort of summer carnival type stuff with water sports and all that sort of thing. Or they start selling condos on the property, all these different things so they can stay alive. And the skiing is less and less of a lucrative thing for them. For one thing, the season is shorter, and for another, they have to make snow, which is very expensive. And in some places, and not just in New England, but in the Rockies and all over the country, it's not always possible to make snow. If the weather gets too warm, they can't even do that. They don't have that option.
Mm-hmm.
And what the people at the ski areas have told me, that suppose you're a Vermont ski area and you've made all this snow and the slopes are fine, even if that's true, people will look out their window in Boston or Connecticut, and they're going to see no snow, and the last thing on their mind will be skiing. So even if it's possible for them to ski, they probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
And all that affects the industry.
There are still, though, you cite what's going on in Canada, where snowmobile sales are up 2%. Will Canada and Russia and name the other countries be the only places you can engage in these wonderful winter sports?
Yeah, maybe, and that also relates to the maple sugaring, because the United States, particularly Vermont, used to produce 80% of the the world's maple syrup.
Ooh.
And Canada produced 20%. Now those numbers are reversed.
Really?
Canada has 80% of the market, and the U.S. has 20%. It's not just that the seasons change and all that. There are other factors, including the fact that in Canada they let people tap trees in the national forests and parks and stuff, and that it's not as subsidized in the U.S., but the weather has definitely changed. They've lost something like a week of their season, and maple syrup manufacture requires a real delicate freeze and thaw cycle. And if that doesn't happen, the whole thing gets thrown off. And a lot of the Vermont maple syrup makers said they don't really expect to have the business. And it's amazing. You know, some of the families I talk to, they can't remember when it started in their family. You know, these are people whose family have been in Vermont 300 years, and they can't really say who the first tapper was. It's beyond their collective memory. And yet they're looking at the end of that. And that, you know, that's kind of affecting.
Right. And how long has this been change going on, Jim?
Oh, well, you could go back to 1970, because since then, average winter temperatures in New England have increased 4.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hmm.
And that's pretty significant. All around the country, we're seeing the warmest year on record. Right now, where I am in Connecticut, it's going to be something like 60 degrees.
Wow.
And this is freakishly warm weather. Now, you may get days when it's 10 degrees, and you think, where's global warming now? But actually, the pattern called for by most climate scientists is just sort of freakishly odd weather. Like, you get these warm snaps where it's 60 degrees. We had, like, 10-degree weather last week. My memory of winter is that it wasn't quite so unpredictable as it is now. If you've read our piece, Losing Winter, you've also seen the recollections we have from a number of people about what their own memories of huge snowfalls were, and being little kids and having 5-foot snowfalls outside and having to tunnel through that and not being able to find your car and all this kind of stuff. I have many memories like that. And I can't recall a snowfall recently that didn't almost immediately melt. So if you build a snowman, he's gone by the next day. Mm-hmm. That is almost always happens now.
And it is true that when we were kids, it didn't happen, right? I remember when it snowed, it snowed.
It stayed around for weeks,
right.
Not months.
Right, months usually.
Yeah, you built something, it was, you know, semi-permanent.
Yeah. So do you have, I know you believe in this, but are scientists confirming now that this is a result of global warming? And then we get into the whole issue of how much of it is human contribution to this. But is there little doubt that the 60 degrees one day and you know, 9 inches of snow the week before, these weird patterns are directly related to global warming?
Well, that would probably be going beyond what science would say, because scientists would not pin any one weather event to global warming.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying Hurricane Katrina was caused by global warming. Like, what scientists know is that global warming warms up the water temperature, and warmer water leads to more hurricanes. And something like Katrina is what you would expect to see. The same thing is true of these very warm winters and the trend we're seeing towards consistently warmer weather. It's what you would expect to see. To confirm that it's all caused by global warming is probably a bit of a stretch scientifically, but it certainly meets the pattern.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you think of a certain part of the country as having kind of a culture, and you write about the eastern part of the United States, and we do think of these wonderful mountains with snow, and we ski on them, and cross-country ski, and maple syrup from Vermont. It's changing the whole culture of that part of the country, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, as I mentioned, maple syrup making in Vermont is such, it's, you know, it's not the biggest industry in the world. I can't think of how much revenue it generates. They only make 300,000 gallons a year. And as I said, it's only 20% of the industry now. But it's still really important to the culture of Vermont. And, you know, snow is part of their culture. It's a big employer. I mean, just moving snow around, salting the roads, all that kind of stuff they do, it's part of their culture. And when that changes, it's Vermont will be a different place.
Let's start welcoming phone calls for Jim. Jim Matavalli is editor of E, the environmental magazine, and we're talking about what happened to winter. His piece is in the January-February issue of E, Losing Winter. As climate change takes hold, our coldest season is the first casualty. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, you can reach us at 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And we start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Fine guest, fine topic. Can I make two comments? One is that the American Horticulture Society has published a revised climate zone map. And essentially, for the United States, they've moved up one for every climate zone. Mm. And it's notable that the Department of Agriculture is going to produce a new one, but it's going to use a time scale which will reduce the apparent change. Second, in 2004, I believe in January, I watched a very earnest woman, who I assume was the wife, trying to persuade a man to leave his ice fishing shack, which was floating around on a diminishing flow in Lake Monona, and he was refusing to go because of the cultural significance of being able to ice fish.
I would confirm what the caller says about changing zones, and I said this to my wife, and she refused to believe it. I mean, people find that really hard to believe. I mean, these zones are pretty fixed, and the thought that you'd be moving up a whole zone is pretty momentous to gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very interesting about ice fishing. I think that's probably something to look at. How has it affected that? You know, I was thinking of Lake Wobegon, where they do that thing where they put a car on the ice and they take bets on when it's going to fall through.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be affected by this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Not only do the ice fishing shacks fall through, but the car in Lake Wobegon.
Right. Did you have anything else, Frank? I don't know if you're still with us. Thanks very much. It's always great to hear from you.
That was interesting.
Yeah, he's always an interesting caller. Let's go to Ray from Milwaukee next. Hi, Ray.
Good morning to you and your guest. I want to start off by saying I'm against the use of fossil fuels. I don't own a car, and I would like to see us using far less of them. But if you want to really seriously talk about global warming, the Earth has been warming or cooling because it always oscillates. It never actually stays the same. That would be very unusual, actually. And what you and your guests are asking is that things stay the same forever. And like an analogy of the human heartbeat, when it's studied and they look at the rhythms, it's actually a little abnormal rhythm, which is the more healthier heart, not the exactly perfect timed rhythm. And I'd like to say the Earth has a way of cooling itself down when it gets too warm and warming itself up when it gets too cold. It just, we're not looking at it overall over millions of years, which I think tree rings give us back maybe 12,000 years. And ice cores go back how many millions, maybe? The Earth is always warming or cooling. We just have to learn how to deal with what's happening and also, why is Mars ice caps melting?
So you're not a believer in human contribution to all of this?
Well, probably, but a far less effect than what we really think. I think the sun right now is having an effect on Mars as well. And there are no people on Mars that I know of. And why is the temperature there also warming?
All right. I want to get into a huge debate this hour about whether or not global warming is happening.
Well, let me just say that I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen An Inconvenient Truth. And if you look at the patterns, which we know from ice cores, what has happened with the climate going back hundreds of thousands of years, you see a definite pattern. The caller is right that climate goes up and down without human input, and it has for thousands of years. But it goes up and down in a fairly predictable pattern within something like 20% until you get to the period where we started burning fossil fuels. And then you see, as Al Gore pointed out, a straightforward rise that has continued to this day and is getting steeper. global warming skeptics are always trying to point out that there's natural rises and falls in climate. That is a total red herring. It doesn't really advance the debate any. And while it may be true, it is not relevant to this issue, I don't think.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let us go to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask him why most climatologists will answer the question about carbon dioxide, but they won't get on to permafrost melting in the tundra and the consequences of the seafloor water warming, like methane gas. They'll talk about other gases, but they won't go beyond carbon dioxide heating up, and it seems really timid.
Well, I think the caller is right that some of these things are what's called tipping points, and I think scientists do talk about them. They talk about reaching a point, it might be something like 500 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, where all these things start to happen that by themselves accelerate the process. One of them is simply the melting of ice, because when ice melts, it turns from a reflective surface to water, which is absorbing heat. So that in itself intensifies the process. And you also have the release of methane from the melting of ice, as the caller said. So I don't think scientists have been avoiding that. I've certainly been hearing about it. It's one of the scare things they mm-hmm. use, that you can have we reach points where all sorts of things are set in motion that we don't want to see, including the release of methane from the seabed and all kinds of unpleasant consequences. So she's right about that.
Thanks, Mary, for the call. Our guest this hour is Jim Matavalli. He's editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, and we are talking about winter and what's happened to winter. It's the cover story of the January-February issue, Losing Winter as Climate Change Sets In. Our coldest season is the first casualty. And we're welcoming your phone calls. We have one line, actually two lines open if you'd like to join us right now at 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome phone calls. I am interested in knowing how people who have to completely change their businesses are responding to all of this, Jim. Those people who run ski hills and do the maple syruping and sell snowmobiles, et cetera. Are they much more keenly interested now in the science of global warming, or is it, well, we'll just go on to another business, or how do they respond?
Respond in both ways that you mentioned. They really are getting a little more interested in global warming. And we did interview a number of athletes whose, they're winter sports athletes, snowboarders and skiers, some of them Olympic competitors or on professional teams like hockey players. And they have a real interest in there being snow. It screws them up totally if it's not
there.
Sure,
yeah.
So they've become climate activists. I mean, that's probably the next step to following global warming as it proceeds to actually being a campaigner to trying to make it stop. And we do have that within our power, so I think that's really good. I'm not sure that snowmobile dealers are becoming climate activists yet, but they've certainly noticed how it's affected their business. And in many cases, if they sell snowmobiles, they probably also sell, off-road vehicles of other types. They're probably selling more of those, and they probably notice that.
We go next to Charlie from Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Kathleen. And I'm one of those cross-country skiers whose life has been totally screwed up by these climate changes. When I first moved to Wisconsin 32 years ago, an exception of one or two weekends a winter when there would be a brief thaw, I could count on cross-country skiing in southeastern Wisconsin from the first weekend in December through the middle of March. And we haven't had a winter that allowed that for at least 15 years now. Hmm. It's totally transformed. We had a great December this year, mm-hmm. but now a lot of the snow is gone. And one of the things I want to comment on that's so irritating is the attitude that the people who report the news and particularly the weather have towards winter. I presume it may be the same in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine as it is here in Wisconsin, is these people act like they have never enjoyed a snowfall or a day in the snow or a ski or a skate in their lives. Yesterday we had a miserable day in Milwaukee that was foggy, rainy, in the 40s, the snow disappearing. And, you know, the weather people act like this is such a break. We are so lucky.
That's very true. That's very true. They're very tuned to warmer is always better.
Yeah, and it's absurd. Give me a day where it's 19, 20 degrees, the sun is shining, there's intense blue sky, and we have great snow to ski on. That's why I moved to Wisconsin. That's what winter's all about.
It's amazing to me why I wrote this piece is that we haven't focused on this at all. I mean, we really have winter and the experience of winter as part of our collective consciousness, and we're losing it without really people paying attention. I mean, we're paying more attention to Britney's sister getting pregnant.
You're right. Well, I hope you got your fill of skiing, Charlie, in December. We had a lot of snow then. But
I did a lot of skiing, but I did not get my fill.
Yeah. Well, I hope it returns. But this week has been so bizarre. Tornadoes? I mean, tornadoes. 60 degrees.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
Tornadoes in January.
Right.
Bizarre weather is part of what global warming predicts. I think it's right on cue.
Hmm. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
If we took this issue quite seriously, would we ever see a return of what our collective memory of winter is?
Well, the only way we can do that is to stop global warming, is to stop that process. And, you know, it's a huge obstacle. If you look at what's been proposed so far, even the Kyoto process, it's only a tiny Band-Aid on what really needs to do. And we've had one of the callers said something about, you know, not being a fan of fossil fuels. Basically, we'd have to stop using fossil fuels. We'd have to find an alternative to that. We'd have to stop burning fuel oil in our burners. I mean, we would really have to change the whole way the planet works. And, you know, there'd be no cars running on any fossil fuels. We'd be getting rid of tailpipes entirely. In order to reverse this process, we'd have to do something that dramatic. And I don't see a collective will around the world yet, even though we're starting to move towards that direction. One thing I find heartening is if you look at the current crop of presidential candidates, none of them, including even Mike Huckabee, who's committed to a cap-and-trade system I was just reading, none of them are deniers of global warming on the level that George W. Bush is.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever becomes president is going to take global warming seriously, and this long period of denial will be over.
Thanks, Charlie. Nice to hear from you. Let's go to Barbara from Hilbert. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I live actually on the east shore of Lake Winnebago, and one of their primary incomes for the entire area around the Winnebago area is the freezing of the lake and the sturgeon spearing and the ice fishing that goes on. And what we've seen is 2 years ago, our lake never froze enough for any of these sports to go on. The following year, we had about two to three weeks, and those of us who were lucky enough to get out, to get off work to go out and do a few days were blessed, but the rest of us were unfortunately unable to do that. So it is impacting, you know, the economy of the area greatly. I mean, it's the fishing in our surrounding area is just a phenomenal import of funds for us, and so it is impacting us. The other comment I wanted to make, along with, you know, the ice fishing and the issues with that, I had a question. I was out to dinner last night with an older relative of mine, and she had mentioned that back in the 70s, there was something, kind of a panic brought up about global cooling. Does anybody remember that? Is that something that occurred? And if so, can you kind of fill me in on that? Because it's something I've never heard of. I was born in the 70s, so.
Yes, I think if you look back, you'd probably find that on the cover of Time or Newsweek sometime in the 1970s. There was a concern about that. And if you saw the movie The Day After Tomorrow, that also concerns that particular issue. There still is a possibility of global cooling, which is part of global warming. It's a little confusing. But basically what they're talking about is the Gulf Stream and the possibility that the Gulf Stream would stop working. And as you probably know, the Gulf Stream carries warm water from the Pacific up to the North Atlantic. And the process by which the glaciers and the Icelandic glaciers and the Greenland glaciers are melting is affecting the Gulf Stream. It's causing about 20% of it to slow down, or to slow down 20%. And the Gulf Stream is what keeps such places as Iceland's one or England a lot warmer than they would otherwise be because of this warm water. England is probably 20% or 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would otherwise be if the Gulf Stream stopped. So without the Gulf Stream, you would definitely see global cooling in northern parts of the world. And it would be going at the same time as global warming effects. So in some ways, they would counter each other.
Hmm.
That's one of the sudden effects that people are talking about. You can have these very bizarre effects triggered by aspects of global warming, and that is one of them.
So it's really the yin and the yang of global warming.
This is another thing that skeptics bring up to say that global warming is not real. They say that in the 70s they were talking about global cooling, and now they're talking about global warming. They can't get their story straight. This means that they're not what they're talking about is not accurate, all that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Barbara, unless you have more.
No, I do have to talk about the previous caller did say that he misses the winter. I'll tell you what, growing up in Wisconsin, I miss the cold.
Mm.
I am not okay with this warm weather.
Mm-hmm.
I want the snow, I want the ice, I want to play outside. That's what I've always done.
Yeah.
And I miss it.
Right.
So.
Right. Thanks very much for your call. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. Part of the hour, of course, is to talk about what our memories are of winters as children. And I think that all of us have noticed some pretty substantial changes and what that means for our lives and what it means for various industries as well. Jim Matavalli is our guest. He is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, and their cover story for February is on losing winter. As climate change sets in, our coldest season is the first casualty. We had a strong winter in December here in Wisconsin, but January has been incredibly peculiar. Let's go to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning to your guest. This question of global warming, you know, people who actually think that with millions of cars driving around just spewing all of this stuff into the air, that, you know, that doesn't have some effect is just, you know, ignorance. But my question to your guest is, if nothing happens or if we just, you know, keep applying little Band-Aids to the problem, can you kind of graphically detail to us what are the consequences? I mean, what could happen? Are we looking for more violent weather? Seawater, sea levels raising, you know, maybe if we understood a little bit better how it would affect us directly, people would pay more attention. Thanks.
Well, I think we're going to see exactly what you just laid out. We're going to see rising sea level. We're going to see warming temperatures. We're going to be seeing changes in animal migration and really animal species, like what you might expect to see outside your window, what kind of animals and birds. That's all going to change as those animals migrate to conditions that are more conducive to them. Some areas, beaches will disappear. That process has already started in the Caribbean. Whole islands in the Pacific have already been threatened. Populations have been evacuated. That will probably accelerate. We're going to have to do a lot. If you look at some of our coastal areas, particularly, say, Florida, and where we developed right along the beach in Florida, those areas are extremely vulnerable. Even cities like Manhattan, which are basically at sea level, are very vulnerable to sea level rise. And we've done very little to prepare for that. A model could be that of Holland, which, as you probably know, is mostly under sea level. A lot of it was reclaimed from the sea. So they're very conscious of their situation, and they've done a whole lot to prepare for it. We've done very little. We you know, the same way the Bush administration has basically denied the reality of global warming. As people, as Americans, we've basically done that too. We've done very little preparation, and I think we'll see the consequences of that. Exactly what form it will take, it depends on so many things. I mean, it depends on how much carbon dioxide we emit in the next 10 years. But we're past the point where we're looking at global warming being something that will happen in 10 or 20 years. It has already started. E is the author of a book called Feeling the Heat, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Change. You can read about that on our website at emagazine.com. And we compiled reports about global warming effects already underway. And all kinds of things are happening around the world with very little notice, including, as I mentioned, tropical islands have been very affected. Many of them are at sea level, and they've lost significant amounts of property and are looking at a whole lot worse. So it's not like this is something in the distant future that we might, our grandchildren have to deal with. We have to deal with it right now, and consequences of dealing with it are pretty big, and that's why we really have to get serious about it. I'm heartened, by the way, that on college campuses, this has become the issue. Global warming is the organizing tool on campuses today. You could not go to a college campus where there's not a significant climate change coalition working on these mm-hmm. issues and greening the campuses and trying to get the policies changed, and even trying to make the whole school carbon neutral, which I think is a really worthwhile goal. So, and they're also campaigning against any new coal plants, which I'm personally very glad to see that happening, and trying to close some of the existing coal plants. Coal is a huge contributor to global warming. It's one of the biggest problems. So the colleges are very tuned into this, and in the absence of any federal action, it's really devolved down to the state and the local level to get active. And that's happening all over the country in many dramatic ways.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Kathy next from Stockbridge. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to contribute just three items. My father-in-law lives in Chilton, Wisconsin. I actually live in Stockbridge. I'm not originally from Wisconsin. And I was doing a report for school with a couple of students regarding global warming, and so I interviewed him. He's 81. He has a lot of input. And he pointed out three things to me. Like the lady from Hilbert, he said Lake Winnebago, in his entire memory from the time he was a child until just this past year, it's the first time last year that he can remember the lake not freezing. He said it's the first time in his life that he did not sturgeon fish.
Mm.
And that was huge. And then the second thing is he owns one of the largest farms in Chilton, and he pointed out to me that farmers are dependent upon those layers of snow that they get here in the winter. He said not only does it seal it, it protects it, but it also waters it.
Mm-hmm.
He said right now for him to look out and see these fields completely bare of snow at this time of year, it's not a good sign for the crops that will be placed in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this is a growing concern here. He said just especially over the past 10 to 15 years, the farmers have steady watched the snow decline. And then the third thing he pointed out, which was interesting since I do own assisted living facilities, is he said to me, he goes, Kathy, you know, 20 years ago, I didn't see people rushing in to get flu shots and pneumonia shots like we do now. He said part of the reason is we're staying warmer here later into the winter. He said, and the things that were basically what we always said wiped out with the first freeze, he goes, they're flourishing. He said the germs are worse, people are sicker. He said, I watch you rushing to inoculate people. He goes, you know, we didn't do that back in our day. He said, it just wasn't around. It froze, it was cold, everybody was healthier. And he said, now with this warming, he said, it seems like people are sicker because the germs are just growing and flourishing. Mm. So three things to think on. It's a little scary.
Could I read a little bit of our story that's reporting from Wisconsin about all this?
Of course.
Yeah, this is a little piece called The Big Chill. And it's sent in by a woman named Wendy Hessler. Between 1965 and 1975, my father worked for the County Highway Department in Chippewa County, Wisconsin, about 100 miles east of Minnesota's Twin Cities. His winter duties included plowing snow with a big yellow grader. The phone would ring early in the morning, alerting my dad that it was time for him to go to work. He would pour coffee in a thermos, take a cold lunch, and spend all day in his grader plowing and replowing, coming home more than 12 hours later. It was cold, well below zero, and windy. Temperatures would remain below freezing for weeks at a time. We just dressed for it. We'd go sledding with cardboard toboggans, railed sleds, saucers, and later blue plastic roll-up sleds on the hill across the street from school. We'd walk to a pond and ice skate. We'd build forts and snow animals and snow caves. Relatives with snowmobiles would give us rides. It was not unusual to get 3 feet or more of snow in a single storm, and the snow would last all winter with one snowstorm piling on top of the next, so by spring there could be 6 feet of snow on the ground.
Hmm.
It goes on, and she says that the Chippewa River, which used to ice over and provide an ice jam spectacle every spring, hasn't frozen solid for years. And I remember stuff like what she's talking about, where the snow would just pile on top of itself and it would never melt. And now it's just one long melting,
mm-hmm.
in my experience.
What about people not being as healthy? Do you have any evidence of that, Jim?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I think there's an issue, which is probably a separate issue, but I think today's kids don't go outside as much and they don't have as much experience of nature. They're more likely to play some winter sports game on their computer than they are to go out and jump in the snow, even if it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, like I said, it's kind of a separate issue, but I have two daughters who are 11 and 13, and trying to get them to go out and build a snowman is kind of an obstacle in a way that I don't recall. We didn't have too many other diversions, so we were out there.
Right.
I remember being sent out in the morning and not coming back till it got dark.
Right, yeah, exactly. Thanks very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about winter and losing winter this hour of the program. Our guest is the editor of E!, the environmental magazine, Jim Ottavalli, and their cover story this January-February is on losing winter as climate change sets in. Our coldest season is the first casualty. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Jim Ottavalli, editor of E!, the environmental magazine, is our guest, and we're talking about what's happened to winter. It's interesting to hear your stories from around the state about what's happening to Lake Winnebago and snowfalls that we used to have, and fathers used to snowplow for 12 hours, and a changed winter that a lot of people have been noticing in Wisconsin and certainly in the country as well. 800-486-8655. Our next call is Wiley from Pigeon Falls. Hi.
Hello. I was, as far as reducing our emissions, I was thinking that it'd be nice if NASA were to take their heads out of the clouds and try to build a hydrogen car. So I'm sure the Chinese must be working for this, because when the technology comes out, it'll surely be profitable, but it'd be a great thing of national pride to accomplish something like that, but I guess you wouldn't see it with this type of president. But
Jim?
Well, let me just say that I've driven every hydrogen car that is on the road, and the impetus for building hydrogen vehicles is not really coming from the federal government, or never really has come from them. They have some investment in research, but both Honda and General Motors are pretty far advanced in building hydrogen vehicles. I think the vehicle itself is very sophisticated, and most people would find it a pleasant experience to drive it. The problem is making hydrogen, which is itself very energy intensive. You have to make it from natural gas, or you can also reform water and get hydrogen that way. But you expend a fair amount of energy to do that, and it costs a fair amount also. Right now, in no way is hydrogen comparable to gasoline and what it would cost. It'd probably be something like $10 a gallon equivalent if it was marketed right now. It goes up and down with the price of natural gas. And the vehicles themselves, the ones I've driven, were worth $2 or $3 million each. And we don't have affordable hydrogen cars yet. So we're still a ways off. I would say more likely, as an interim step, what we're going to see is the plug-in hybrid vehicle, which is the next step from common hybrids like the Prius. And essentially, if you take something like the Prius and add a bigger battery pack, you can then drive it 30 or 40 miles on just the batteries alone. So if you have a 10-mile commute, you probably never need to use the gas engine. And I would say that within 2 years, Honda, Toyota, GM, they're going to have these cars on the market. GM is working hard on it. Honda's working hard on it. Toyota's working on it.
Within how many years? What did you say?
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, they've committed to it. Both GM and Toyota have committed to building plug-in hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really seen them yet, but I think it's the logical next step from hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Right now, I don't know how many Priuses you see on the road there, but they are largely a coastal phenomenon right now. They sell very heavily on the East Coast, and I was out in the Pacific Northwest where in some places they're the most popular car, and it's amazing how many of them you see. And to me, the big failure of the American automotive industry is that it has no real competitor to that. The Prius has maybe 80% or more of the hybrid market, which is crazy.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, we keep putting out these hybrids that are huge SUVs. That's what GM does. That's what Ford does. That's what Chrysler does. And to me, there's no market for that. We need a competitor for the Prius. I don't know why they don't see that.
Mm.
I mean, I certainly write about it a lot, but it hasn't convinced them. Mm. But I would say the hydrogen car is a way off. NASA has no involvement in it at all.
What?
It's the Department of Energy that is investing in it.
Well, I think it's just a great, or a group of people who are scientifically minded who could put their minds to something that's more practical for what we need in society. I actually drive an Insight, a Honda Insight.
Oh, that's a great car. That is right now on the road probably the most fuel-efficient car you could buy. They're not selling it anymore, but that thing will get 70 miles per gallon.
Ooh-wee. Isn't that something?
It's unfortunately only a two-seater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I take it into the dealer. They plug it in and charge the battery all the way up for me.
Hmm.
But that's not a plug-in hybrid. We haven't seen those yet.
How old is it, Wiley? How old is your car?
It's a 2001.
2001. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for your call. 800-486-8655 is in our number, and we're talking about what's happened to winter. Jerry from Little Chute. Hi.
Good morning. I was happy to hear your discussion about the hybrid car just now. I think what it'll ultimately wind up doing is bringing back the need for nuclear power, because of course all of these hybrid cars need to have their batteries charged, and the amount of electricity we generate in order to charge those is going to have to come from coal, which is going to add to the carbon load, of course, in the country. And ultimately, we're going to be screaming for more clean energy, and we're ultimately going to wind up with nuclear, I think. But the real reason for my call was I was wondering the Bali conference. I know that there's groups of scientists that have been trying to get their voices heard about global warming and some of the overstatements and mischaracterizations and misinformation that's out there, and you know, warning people not to just go overboard and buy into all of this. But they are not allowed to speak at this conference. And one of the things that I remember back on was when Al Gore was at the made his presentation in Congress last April, I believe it was. It was so filled with journalists. There was people, you could hardly even hear him speak because of the camera noise at times. And then about an hour later, 1 hour later, in the same room, Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist, whose credentials I'm sure you'll assail, but who basically...
It's not his credentials all assail.
Well,
it's what he writes
all assail. He presented a very nice, very well-reasoned argument as to why we shouldn't just jump into everything about global warming without thinking about the economic consequences of it, first of all. And
okay, let's get a response to this. We continue to debate this issue. Jim?
Well, Bjorn Lomborg is a very well-known climate skeptic. A number of environmental groups have published, particularly on the Internet, detailed responses to his claims about global warming. I can't go into it in any great depth here. He has a new book specifically on climate change, which I have, but I haven't read yet, so I'm not going to go into its findings. But the number of climate skeptics like Bjorn Lomborg is really thinning. The ranks are thinning, and many of the skeptics have moved over to cautious acknowledgement that global warming is real. It's really not a very big group, and it's even smaller than it was a few years ago, because there's just so much evidence, the weight of evidence of this being real. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which represents something like 2,500 climate scientists, which is probably most of the ones in the world, have gotten much more strong in their statements about the reality of global warming and the fact that it's being caused by human action. And the evidence that people have seen, and I was just reading a New York Times piece about the melting glaciers in Greenland, where they're forming what's called moraines, which are sort of underground rivers. All the water that's melting off the glaciers is itself accelerating the process. And it's leading the scientists to conclude that this melting is going to happen faster than they had anticipated. If the Greenland ice sheet was to melt, it would significantly raise sea level, and we would see widespread flooding. I mean, whether that'll happen in our lifetimes is unclear, but scientists have definitely concluded it's happening faster than they've ever expected it to happen. And I really wouldn't put a lot of weight in Bjorn Lomborg, and he has, I would say, fewer and fewer colleagues every year.
What about his point that this will really disrupt our economy? And let's bring it back to winter for a moment, and those people who have been involved in clothing for winter and maple syrup and ski hills and snowmobiles and all of that. It's really disrupted their way of life as well. Is this what fuels this denial of global warming?
Yes.
Would there be a significant economic problem because of this?
Oh, yes. And this is the cry of the global warming skeptics, that addressing global warming will hurt the economy. And that's undoubtedly true. I would never try to sugarcoat this. I think it'll have a huge effect on the economy. But the consequences of not doing it are bigger. That's what we have to come to grips with. You can't have the kind of planetary changes we're talking about here without having major economic effects. And we've been talking about a few industries that have already been affected, having to do with winter sports and things like that. But many, many other industries, particularly agriculture, are going to be severely affected by the worst global warming effects. I mean, desertification is one of the things we're likely to see. And long-term droughts, those are all predicted by global warming, and we've seen those. For instance, Australia has been in the grip of a long-term drought for years now. And other parts of the world, in India, they've seen significant droughts. So to talk about we can't do global warming mitigation because it'll hurt the economy is, to me, pretty ludicrous because of all the economic effects that will happen if we don't do something about it. I think it's worse than the effects of changing our economy. I also think that if you look at the green economy, the building of wind turbines and solar panels and biomass
yes.
plants and all the other things that we can do, these also create jobs and they stimulate the economy, but in a different way. And I think we can change the economy without sending it into the ground and also address global warming. We just have to think differently.
Mm-hmm.
This is my big criticism of the auto industry. There's a golden opportunity for them to sell fuel-efficient cars. They're hugely losing market share to the Japanese because they refuse to do this. Look at the list in Consumer Reports of the 15 most fuel-efficient cars. There's not a single one made in Detroit. If you want to buy a fuel-efficient car, you have no option to buy an American vehicle. That, to me, is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Don't they realize they're facing a changed market? The industry has to change or it's going to be swept away by this, in my view.
Yeah. So where are you talking to us from right now, Jim?
I'm in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Uh-huh. And do you have snow?
There are very tiny patches of snow that are probably about a foot across, and by the time I go out to lunch, they'll probably be gone, because it's something like 55 degrees right now.
Isn't that something?
It's insane. It was something like, it reached, I think, 65 yesterday.
Yeah, we had that on Monday. It was that kind of weather.
And, you know, it's definitely warmer here than it is in Wisconsin, but not that much warmer. Usually, we would have snow and we would have consistent 20 or 30 degree weather at this time of year.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jim, so much for being with us. Thanks for the article. I would like to go ice skate now if I really want to do it.
Hey, can I mention that I have this new book coming out?
Well, sure, why not?
It's called Naked in the Woods.
Naked
in
the Woods.
Isn't that provocative? It's about this guy who went naked into the woods of Maine in 1913 to prove he could live off the land.
Oh, my gosh, it sounds fascinating.
Oh, it is. It's a true story.
Ah.
And something like 100,000 people greeted him in Boston when he came out of the woods.
Oh, is it out now?
It's coming out in the 1st of February.
Okay.
We'll... got photos, too.
All right, you sold it. We'll book you for that. That'd be great.
I hope so.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Matavalli, editor of E! Magazine, the environmental magazine. The cover story, Losing Winter as Climate Change Sets In Our Coldest Season, is the first casualty. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Abigail Nelson for on-air production. I also meant to thank Carmen Jackson last hour for producing the Carl Bernstein segment of the show, too. So thanks, Carmen. And for all of your calls, thank you. We'll be with you again tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.